All right, so I want to tell you some stories of paleo detectors, a semi-crazy idea, and I hope to convince you in this talk, not entirely crazy, but only a little bit, to search for dark matter and other signals like astrophysical neutrinos. And this is a, by now, this has evolved into a whole series of works that started something like 3 years ago with a large list of people, so I cannot go through all of them anymore. But at least I've written them down here. All right, so let's start. Let me just remind you of the very basic concept of what we're trying to do and sort of the classical idea of direct detection of dark matter, right? So the idea is we have some dark matter particle. And for this talk, you should have in mind sort of a classical, something like a weakly interactive massive particle, something roughly as heavy as a atomic nucleus within some orders of magnitude, and that has some possible weak interactions with feeble interactions with ordinary nuclei. So the idea is we're trying to search for these interactions of these dark matter particles with ordinary atomic nuclei by essentially putting a lot of ordinary atomic nuclei together somewhere and watching them very closely and asking if one of them receives a little kick by some dark matter particle coming by and happening to interact with this nucleus. And there's two big challenges conceptually in this type of search. One is that the kick that the ordinary nucleus gets from the dark matter particle is very weak. Typically, we're talking about a few keV of energy. So this is very hard to detect. So you have to have some very sensitive detector to small atomic recoils, nuclear recoils. And so one idea is something like this, which is the typical idea of the liquid noble gas time projection chamber experiments, something like xenon, you know, xenon LZ, etc., where you use a scintillator essentially to look for these tiny nuclear recoils. The second challenge is that these recoils are very rare. Otherwise, we would have long seen them. The interactions of dark matter with atomic nuclei, if exist at all, are extremely feeble. And so, in order to enhance your sensitivity, what you have to do is you have to assemble more and more and more atomic nuclei to look for their recoils. You have to build a bigger and bigger detector. And people have been playing this game for by now something like 40 years, and it's come a long, long, long way, right? So this was the first experiment that I know of to look for direct detection, to do direct detection in the lab. Unfortunately, I could not find a nice picture of it. So this was in 87, and it was a few hundred grams of germanium. And fast forward to 2021, where we now have detectors on the sort of 10-ton scale. So we have gone a very, very long way in this, but unfortunately, as you know, to date, we have not found any such dark matter. So the typical plot that you see, and this will reappear during the talk, is something that looks like this, the Wnt mass on the x-axis, the dark matter mass, and the interaction cross-section on the y-axis. And what you typically see on these plots are just exclusion limits, right? From a bunch of different experiments. And with the progress in these detectors, building these very large detectors, and the 10-ton class is expected to operate or to give us results in, you know, the next year or so, the first results, these limits have become very, very strong. You see that the cross-sections being probed and tiny, something like 10 to the minus 46 square centimeters at the best. Nonetheless, we still would like to try to find WIMPs or any other form of dark matter for that matter. So the question is, how do we keep going into the future, right? What do we do to keep making these bonds stronger and stronger? And of course, as you know, there is a program in place to build ever bigger and bigger detectors, as well as to build detectors that are sensitive to ever smaller and smaller masses. The most important challenge there is to lower the threshold of your detector, the nuclear energy threshold. What are the softest recoil that you can measure? But these type of experiments are becoming ever harder to operate. So what we were thinking about is there a different way of how you could do direct detection of dark matter? And these are artist impressions that people have put on articles that were written about this, of how people capture our idea. So I'll tell you more about it, of course, but you'll see it has something to do with rocks and maybe some particular type of rocks that are crystals. All right, so the basis behind our ideas is to, instead of building a normal detector where you look for some nuclear recoil, is to use what's called a solid state nuclear track detector. So what you're seeing in these pictures are microscopic images taken of different crystals, different minerals. And these marks you're seeing in there are the traces of nuclear recoil tracks in that material. So this, in all of these pictures, the tracks stem from the spontaneous fission of uranium. So the uranium undergoes fission. You get two fission fragments that recoil from each other with something like 100 MeVs or so of energy. They make a nice long track. As they flow through the material, they essentially mess up the material and leave this track that you can then later see with a microscope. And note that all of these pictures are taken in the 60s. So this is technology that was available in the 60s. I have, in the left picture, you'll see these damage tracks taken with transmission electron microscopy. The scale down here is 1,000 angstroms. You can also image these tracks, or you already could image these tracks in the 60s with optical microscopy. What you had to do then is to somewhat enlarge these damaged features by a process called chemical etching. So what you did is and this is a dark art, people just tried and figured out what worked. You put some chemical agent on your sample that happens to, in this particular mineral, preferentially eat away these damaged features and enlarges them, and it eats away them faster than the otherwise regular part of the crystal. So you can make these damaged features a little larger, and then you can even image them with optical microscopes. On the right picture, again, after chemical etching, but now in a different mineral, this is gypsum, which is a salt, the same stuff you build casts out of, by the way. Here, the damaged features, and then imaged with X-ray microscopy, here the damaged features are actually, the tracks are these black dots. These long sort of track-like looking features are artifacts that come from the sample preparation. And now fast forward to what you could do today. These are modern pictures with modern transmission electron microscopy of such tracks. So what people have done here is they've shot ions at particular minerals at particular targets in a controlled experiment, and then taking very high resolution pictures of these tracks. See here, note the scale. This is something like 2 nanometers. So what these pictures are actually are no longer like what you see here, sort of, you know, you see there's this long track. But this is the cross section of the track. Both of these left pictures, what you're seeing is a track going inside or out of the screen. So what you can see is these tracks are sort of, you know, a few nanometer in diameter. On the bottom right, you see a track that goes from the top to the bottom. Again, the scale here is cut off, but it's something like 5 or 10 nanometers in diameter, and you see it's long. So what I want to mainly impress you with these pictures is that atomic nuclei, when they plow through a crystal lattice, and here in these pictures you very nicely see otherwise the regular crystal lattice, they mess up the crystal structure and leave a lasting damage track. And with existing microscopy technology, we can then go and we can find these damage tracks. So that is the basic idea behind paleo detectors. Instead of building a big laboratory experiment and watching it very carefully to see if dark matter comes by and kicks an atomic nucleus around, can we use the natural detectors that Earth has given us? Can we use a crystal that has been sitting around somewhere on Earth that might have recorded any such damage tracks that are that come about from dark matter coming in, interacting with the nucleus, kicking that nucleus around, and then the nucleus leaving a track as it goes through the material? Can we use such a detector to look for dark matter?
Hi, Sebastian. Can I ask you something about those tracks? So these tracks are defects in the crystal.
Yes.
So what are actually these tracks? So you destroy this crystal structure?
I'll show you in a few slides. Okay.
Okay.
And then we can talk about it again if there's more questions.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, so before going to the details of the tracks, let me point out some of the, you know, sort of bigger picture ideas of what you could do with this. So Earth has provided many of these minerals that are lying around on Earth, right? And it turns out that it's not just one or two very particular crystals that work for this, that are solid-state track detectors, but many, many natural minerals are good solid-state track detectors. And essentially, all you need to have is your material has to be an insulator or at least a poor semiconductor in order to work as a track detector. And even nicer, once you make these damage tracks, in many materials, they last more or less forever. And in particular, they can last for a time scale that is long compared to the age of the Earth, they can last much longer than 1 billion years. Just as an example, in diamond, for example, at room temperature, these damage tracks have fading times on the order of something like 10 to the 40 or 50 years. So some absurdly long time scale. So for practical purposes, in many minerals, once you make such a track, in any time during the history of our galaxy or the Earth, it will stay around forever and it will not disappear. And I've already said, so of course, natural minerals, because they can be roughly as old as the age of the Earth, Earth is something like 4.5 billion years old, natural minerals can be as old as something like 1 billion years. It took Earth a little bit of time to cool down, become a nice quiet place where minerals could form and sit and live in a nice, stable, coldish environment. But minerals routinely found on Earth are something like 1 billion years old. And then, as I showed you before with these pictures, with modern microscopy technology, it now seems feasible to read out any such damage track with nanometer scale resolution. So what does all of this buy you? The age of the mineral buys you an enormous exposure. So imagine you can read out something like 100 grams of material that has been recording these damage tracks for 1 billion years. If you want to match that exposure with an ordinary laboratory real-time experiment that you can say operate for 10 years if you're optimistic, you would have to build a 10 kiloton detector. And I don't think anybody's dreaming of building a 10 kiloton direct detection liquid xenon detector. It would be beautiful, but I think it's just orders of magnitudes away of what we can do. And what does this this readout resolution buy you? Essentially, you can think about it, and I'll show you this in a minute. You can think about this as the shortest tracks you can see correspond to your nuclear energy threshold. What are the softest nuclear recoils you can read out? And so this resolution promises, in some instances, sub KV recoil thresholds. So if you put these two things together, what you end up is conceptually a detector that has an exposure on the order of on the order of something like Super Kamiokande, large water Cherenko detectors that we have, kiloton, 100 kiloton years exposures, but with energy thresholds that are comparable to what you can reach in a modern direct detection experiment. We're not the first to think of this idea. We're picking up an old idea in some sense that has been tried. And there are existing limits in the 90s. By Dan Snow and Ifton collaborators. So they've done this, they picked up a sample of natural mica and looked for damage tracks in there. They've produced limits, they didn't see anything. But you see, if you just look at the numbers, these limits are of course many orders of magnitude away from what you can do nowadays with direct detection experiments. If we go back to this plot, you know, we would end up a few orders of magnitude even above this whole axis. So what has changed? Why do we think it is worth to try this idea again? And as I've showed you earlier, microscopy technology to read out such damage track has rapidly improved in the last decades. And this is largely driven by developments in trying to build nanometer scale structures, both for industries and for research. So we believe that the modern microscopy technology that is available makes it worth to try this idea again. All right, so let's get to Mina's question. What are these tracks? Unfortunately, there is no good first principle model that allows you to calculate everything about these tracks. But there are models that describe certain aspects of them. So one of them is the thermal spike model. So here the idea is you have your ion going through your material. As it goes through the material, it interacts with the electrons that sit around via ordinary electromagnetic interactions. And essentially it starts kicking all of the electrons around a little bit, they shake, then the electrons, of course, they interact with their neighbors, etc. And everything, all the electrons clouds start to move a little bit around. What is that? There's nothing but heat. So what happens is you build up a what they call a thermal spike in this model, and you locally melt the material along the track of that your ion takes. And in many materials, as this material refreezes, it will not refreeze into the regular crystal lattice, but it will form an amorphous structure. And this is what you've seen in the picture. This is actually sort of a amorphous core of the track inside this otherwise regular crystal lens. There's another model called the ion explosion model that captures another aspect of track formation. So here now the idea is you have all the atomic nuclei sitting around in the regular crystal lattice. You have your ion traveling through. Again, the ion interacts with the electron clouds. It kicks all of the electrons away a little bit. Now suddenly the nuclei realize, oh, well, we're all ions because the electrons are gone. There's excess excess electric charge. So they start repel each other. And so the ions drift outwards. And because it's a poor conductor, they can't just like flow back in. So what happens is that you leave essentially a source, a region of mechanical stress in the material where the ions are displaced from this regular crystal lattice. So these two models, they describe different aspects of what these tracks are. Part of the tracks is sort of mechanical stress in the crystal lattice. Other parts of the tracks come from forming this amorphous structure as you locally deposit heat in the material. As I said, unfortunately, there is no first principle model that allows you to calculate in a general material for a general ion, for example, right? What is the minimal energy, deposition you need to make to create a track, et cetera. But luckily, of course, we can go in the lab and we can calibrate this and we can measure these tracks, right? So the absence of a first principle model that allows you to explain if this shouldn't stop you. Mina, does this sort of answer your question or do you want to talk more about tracks?
Yeah, see, the thing, I'll tell you exactly what confusing. First of all, is about threshold. Wouldn't you require more than kV of energy to actually push so many atoms around? That's one thing. Like the more spectacular the track, the higher the energy deposition, I would imagine. That's one thing. The other thing that's, I'll tell you, bottom line is this 10 to the 9 years. Like if you heat up the crystal, it would want to go back to its equilibrium configuration, right?
That's right.
So this 10 to the 9, how robust is it? Even things that are insulating, I would imagine that they do want to go back to where this is a very local, high, out of equilibrium situation.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. You're absolutely right. So the first part, right? What is the threshold energy that you need? As you can imagine, the threshold is not so much of course, in the end, it comes down to what is the nucleus you start with. But in some way, people have tried for a long time to understand the threshold is something like the stopping power. What is the minimal stopping power you need, right? How much mm-hmm. energy do you locally deposit? Mm-hmm. And that can vary wildly from material to material. It turns out that in the end, just the stopping power actually isn't a good criterion. And there is, again, this is part of unfortunately, there is no first principle model, so you have to go in a lab and measure it. But people have also tried this later, and people are trying it now again to do feasibility studies for paleo detectors. But there are results from back in the days when then Sloan Ift and collaborators tried this. And so they've calibrated and shown that even if you have, 1-2 kV ions, you do create a damage track that you can go and read out. So it's not very well understood from first principles what the threshold energy are. But it turns out that, and it's been experimentally shown that you do get tracks even for very low threshold energy. Now, to go to the temperature question, you're absolutely right that as you make the mineral, the hotter you make your sample, the faster these tracks disappear. And heuristically, you can understand that what happens is that it's called the annealing time. This annealing time is exponentially suppressed with the ratio of the temperature that you're at and the melting temperature of your crystal. So how sensitive you are to the local temperature really depends on what type of crystal you're looking at, right? Are you looking at a mineral that melts at 100 degrees Celsius, then this might be troublesome. But if you're looking at a mineral like, say, diamond, for example, that has very high melting temperatures, right? You can live with energy with temperatures that are substantially hotter than something like 100 degrees Celsius. and still get very long annealing times. Again, this is something that we yeah. measure in the lab, right? So how people understand this is what you do is you create a bunch of tracks, you heat up your mineral, and then you measure mm-hmm. how fast do they disappear, and you map this, and you have to do this at relatively high temperatures in order to get them to disappear fast enough. And then you have to hope that it extrapolates deep down, down to low temperatures. A check how people have done this experimentally to confirm that it actually holds is the sort of the predecessor of these ideas to look for these tracks that come from something like dark matter was that this technology to look for these damage tracks comes from geologists trying to date minerals. So what people do is you pick up a sample, you measure the uranium concentration in that sample and other heavy radioactive contaminants. Mm-hmm. And then having a measurement of the uranium concentration, you then go and you count these fission tracks, these long nice tracks you get. We know the fission rate, right? The spontaneous fission rate. So then counting the fission, the number of the density of fission tracks and knowing the uranium concentration, you can determine the age of the mineral. In order to do that though, you have to know how fast do the tracks fade. And then you use a different dating technique as a cross-check, and this way you can calibrate this.
Sorry, but wouldn't that depend on the history of that particular piece of crystal that people took? If for some reason one day it was sitting to something that was mildly radioactive, then that will change the results, right?
Sorry, say again.
So wouldn't that depend on the history of the particular piece of crystal that you're studying, in the sense that maybe one day the crystal was just by chance sitting by something else that was radioactive and put tracks into the crystal?
Okay, very good. So yes, so it depends on the history of the mineral. It doesn't matter so much it depends on what you're looking for exactly. If you're doing fission track dating, it doesn't depend so much what you're sitting next to. Because the tracks come from uranium undergoing spontaneous fission within your actual sample, right? Of course, you know, you can cook up an idea where you have a big neutral flux going through your sample that stimulates fission, right? But that needs a quite big neutron flux in order to be effective. So the history that is much more important is the thermal history of the sample, because that affects how fast these tracks fade. So that is something that people worry about and that people do take into account when they do this fission track analysis. And so what one would do in a paleodetector type experiment is that one would, for example, one would look at these fission tracks and exactly understand, use these to calibrate, for example, the thermal history of your sample.
Okay, and how do you distinguish dark matter tracks from these uranium tracks?
I'll get there.
Okay, you'll get there.
Okay. All right. It's this slide essentially. The way to distinguish what the tracks come from comes from measuring how long are the tracks. So what we use in our calculations is we use the stopping power and then integrate that as a proxy for the length of the track. Of course, it's not a perfect proxy in the end. You want to go and actually calibrate it in the lab. But it's just using the stopping power is a fairly good proxy to get the length of the track, because it turns out that these tracks are fairly straight. They don't get very curly and fold back onto themselves typically. And so then what you end up with is in essence a one-to-one correspondence of the nuclear recoil energy and the length of a track. So here I'm showing you this for gypsum, a particular mineral, but you can, these tracks look this plot looks within order one factor similar in more or less any natural mineral you can find. And you'll see that, of course, the different constituent nuclei, if they would be recoiling with such a nuclear recoil energy, there is a slight difference in how long the track from one nuclear recoil would actually be from different elements, but it's a relatively small difference. So you can see that, you know, if you measure the length of the track, you do get information about the energy of the nuclear recoil. So what would happen is that these spontaneous fission tracks, the fission fragments have energies of tens of MeV to 100 MeV. They make sort of 10 micron long tracks, roughly. What a dark matter interaction would do is it would impart something on the order of a kV of energy on your nuclear recoils. So you would make tracks that are, you know, maybe 10 nanometers or so long. So the way we imagine distinguishing the signal from backgrounds, and I'll talk about more backgrounds in a minute, is to use the track, the distribution of the length of the tracks to infer the nuclear recoil energy distribution, which you then use just in, for example, an ordinary direct detection experiment to distinguish certain sources of tracks from sources of recoils from the backgrounds.
So, sorry, just a question here.
Yeah.
This one-to-one correspondence, is that what you're using in the analysis? Or do you have a smearing matrix?
We smear. Yes, we account for finite resolution. Okay.
And is this more or less Gaussian? Does it have a long tail towards lower?
Very good. So we assume that it's Gaussian. That we don't know that. That is something. So in our analysis, we assume there's a Gaussian smearing. In reality, that's of course something that we don't know that has to be calibrated in the lab. Mm-hmm.
But
and that would, of course, have a big effect in principle.
But what's any pre-path of, say, a KeV photon in your particular material?
So photons don't leave tracks. They don't kick nuclei around, right? They interact with the electrons, but the stopping power of a photon is so low that it doesn't impart a lasting damage feature. Same for electrons. So it's very nice that what these type of damage the nuclear track detectors do is they're sensitive. They're sensitive to nuclear recoils. Ions traveling through the material above a certain charge leave tracks. A hydrogen atom, for example, doesn't leave a track. A proton doesn't leave a track. And basically, the stopping power is too low.
It's true that it doesn't interact with the nuclei. It just gets stopped by the electrons. But that's one of the effects that you were thinking about. So a KeV photon may interact with the electrons, just like kick them around, and then just like make them leave, and then you will have these ions that will try to repack themselves and you will form the...
You're right, but the stopping power isn't large enough.
The EDX
isn't large enough. So you have to, interacting with the electrons does change the crystal, right? As in this model that I showed, but you have to sufficiently strongly interact the electrons, right? There's a limit, right? Say I take a muon, it's minimally ionizing, it goes through, maybe it kicks a little bit electron here or there, but you take a nucleus with say charge 10, it goes through there, it interacts much, much stronger. It also has a much higher mass, right? It interacts much, much more strongly with the electrons around. And so you can see it locally deposits much, much more energy. And if you're thinking about this as depositing heat, locally melting the crystal, you can see that you need the stopping power is sort of a critical way that tells you if you...
I see, and electrons will be the same. So a KeV electron, a KeV electron will get stopped in like really quickly in the material, right?
That's true. But so again, this is something that you can just compare the stopping powers, or you could go and you could look and experiment. In these type of minerals, nobody has ever seen a damage track from an electron or a muon or a photon or even a proton. In plastics, so in plastic detectors, people have seen tracks from protons.
Okay.
But not in crystal detectors. Okay. So one more point I want to make on this plot is what you can also read off from this is you can get an idea for what is the nuclear recoil energy threshold of such an experiment. So imagine you could read out tracks that are as short as 1 nanometer. It doesn't make sense to think about tracks that are orders of magnitude shorter than a nanometer, and that's because the typical separation between nuclei in your crystal lattice is on the order of a few angstroms. So if you want to call it a track, that it makes a dislocation that stretches across a few crystal lattice sites, it should be as long as a nanometer at least. So imagine you could read out these shortest tracks. Your nuclear energy threshold corresponds to something on the order of some tenths of EV. So this is comparable to what, if you go back to the normal direct detection experimental world, this is comparable to what you can reach in cryogenic bolometric experiments. Instead, if you have a readout technology that allows you to read out tracks on the order of 10, 20 nanometers, the shortest tracks, then the nuclear energy threshold it corresponds to is a few KeV. So this would give you an experiment with an energy threshold comparable to what is achievable in something like a xenon experiment, a liquid noble gas type thyroid detection experiment. All right, so let me come to the backgrounds. I'm not worried about nuclear spontaneous fission backgrounds from the fission fragments itself. So I'm not going to talk about them. And the reason, as I said, is already they are many orders of magnitude longer than the tracks that dark matter interactions would give you. But let's talk about a number of other backgrounds. And in the end, I'm going to come back to other radiogenic backgrounds. So let's start by natural defects, right? We're not longer operating a controlled laboratory experiment where you get to monitor it very carefully. You can reject events if you don't like them for some aspect of this particular event. You cannot very carefully choose what is your detector built out of, etc. But what we're proposing is to pick up some rock that has formed a billion years or so ago by nature and using that as our detector. So of course there are natural defects in crystals as they grow. And I'm not an expert. By large, I'm not an expert on minerals, but we talked with experts, of course, and asked them. And the answer that we got was that natural defects of minerals do not look like damage tracks that are 10 nanometers or so long, or hundreds of nanometers long. But natural defects as a crystal grows are either single site in the crystal lattice or stretched across the whole monocrystalline domain. So they are either much larger or much smaller than the type of samples, than the type of backgrounds we're looking for. So we're not worried about natural defects. Next thing you can ask is cosmogenics, right? Something else that causes nuclear recalls or directly causes ions traveling through your material are cosmic rays, right? They can either directly make charged cosmic rays going through your sample, or you can have some interaction of the cosmic ray close to your sample that then causes an ion that goes through your crystal. The way we propose to deal with this is exactly the same as what you do in a direct detection experiment. To pick a sample that is buried deep underground and hence shielded from cosmic rays. But there's one crucial difference now. We're not trying to operate a ton scale experiment in a laboratory that you have to send people to build it and to actively monitor it, but which we're only proposing to get, order maybe a kilogram or so of sample material from very deep down. And such materials you can get from much, much, much deeper down than where you can operate a lab that people can go into. And it turns out if you go to depth quite quickly, the most dangerous cosmogenic background becomes neutrons. Now these neutrons come from cosmic ray muons interacting somewhere close to the location of your sample with the rock and then causing neutrons. And the reason neutrons are so dangerous is they do exactly what dark matter does, the way sort of MeV neutrons lose their energy in a material is by elastically scattering off atomic nuclei and causing nuclear recalls. So the most dangerous background are cosmogenic neutrons. So here I'm showing you the neutron flux in units appropriate to something like the paleo detector per square centimeter per giga year. So if you would go to a rock, a depth of 2 kilometers rock, the neutron flux would be something like 10 to the 6 per square centimeter per giga years. And that would, so this is a depth that is comparable to what we have, the existing direct detection experiment. That would cause a background rate that is far too large to deal with if you want to do a competitive direct detection search in a paleo detector. But if you go to depth of 5 or 6 kilometers or so, you end up with a background rate, a neutron rate that is much, much lower. So in a typical paleo detector, say it's a square centimeter and a giga year old, you would get, a few neutrons going through there, and they would cause a few backgrounds. But as I will also show you, we're not longer trying to operate a background-free experiment, like in a conventional direct detection experiment. We're only trying to suppress the backgrounds to a sufficiently small level that one can deal with them and they don't overshadow your signal too much. So if you can pick up a sample from 5 or 6 or so kilometers of depth, one would be in business with the cosmogenic backgrounds. And one way that we thought about how you could do this is there's existing boreholes. These are some of them spread out all over the world. And people routinely by now drill down to depth much, much larger than 5 or 6 kilometers. So here I've only put the deepest ones on there. There's a large number of boreholes that reach down to 5 or 6 kilometers. And the reason these are drilled are mostly either for geological purposes or for doing oil exploration.
So can I ask you something? So how much do stones move? Because they move, right? So it's not like they stay at the same depth. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely, absolutely. So over the course of giga years, right, these are geological timescales. Obviously, things move around. Now, luckily, there's a whole discipline of science that studies how stuff moves around on Earth, right? So geologists understand these things very well. And yes, it's something you have to be worried about because, for example, you don't want your rock to have been sitting at 1 kilometer depth for most of its time and only recently drifted down to 5 kilometer and then you dig it out. But there are many zones on Earth where things are relatively calm and people understand how these shifts work. So you have to be a little bit careful of from where you pick up your sample. But then also there's a nice cross check, right? So what you can do is you take samples, for example, along your borehole from different depths, and you check, right? How does the background contribution from cosmogenics, how does that behave? How does that scale with the depths of the sample, right? Does that scale in the way I expect it to from what I understand about the history of these samples, how deeply they were buried, or is there something strange going on? Okay.
But I guess what I still don't understand is why are you only worried about the cosmogenic neutrons? So there will be also events just from radioactivity, from stuff around the rock. Okay. Okay, cool.
Okay. So radiogenic backgrounds. Okay. So yes, you have to be very worried about radiogenic backgrounds. Okay. Again, the way you would deal with this is similar to an ordinary direct detection experiment. You would try to find a sample living in an environment that is relatively radio pure, right? So if you pick up a typical rock that forms in the crust of the Earth, it has typical uranium concentration of something on 10 to the minus 6 per weight uranium, and that would lead to prohibitively large radiogenic backgrounds. Luckily, Earth has been nice, geology is nice, and there are sources of much, much, much cleaner materials on Earth. One of them is the mantle of the Earth. So it just turns out to be so. I don't know if there's any particular reason for it or if it's just a nice quirk of nature, that the mantle of the Earth is much more radio pure than the crust. Now note that if the mantle of the Earth wouldn't be much more radio pure than the crust, Earth would look very different. The reason for that is that the heat source of the Earth, as you go down in the Earth and you're away from the sun, the surface being heated by the sun, the heat source of the Earth are radiogenic decays. So if the mantle of the Earth would be as rich in uranium as the crust, Earth would look quite differently because it would be much hotter at this depth. So the mantle is much more radio pure, and typical minerals that are found there are, for example, olivine is a group of minerals, are one of the very typical types of minerals being found that have formed from material in the mantle. And samples have been found with uranium concentrations as low as something like 10 to the minus 10, 0.01 parts per billion. So a few may orders of magnitude cleaner than materials formed from the crust. Another source of very radio pure materials are the seas. So ocean water turns out to be extremely radio pure. And historically, over geological timescales, as an ocean evaporates, what tends to happen is that you form a layer of salt deposits at the bottom. And these salt deposits are called marine evaporites, and they can be extremely radio pure. And we think that now this has not been done as closely experimentally. People haven't looked for particularly clean samples, but from what we understand about these salt deposits, we believe that it should be possible to with not a very large effort, to find samples that are even an order of magnitude cleaner than these mantles. Now, I've just said, right, they form relatively close to the surface at the bottom of these evaporating oceans. And I've previously told you something about cosmogenics. So if you want to use a marine evaporite sample as your target material, you have to use a geological process that's in fact very common in salt deposits. So what happens is these salt deposits, they form close to the surface, but then they closely over geological timescales, they get buried as material is deposited on top of them, and they go down to great depth. And now what happens at this great depth is you build up so much pressure on these samples, on these deposits, and it also the temperature also rises, that at some point these materials recrystallize, and locally to escape the pressure, they shoot up and form salt domes and go to somewhat shallower depth where they refreeze and then happily live there for geological timescales. So what you have is a very nice mechanism where you form these very pure materials. They then sink down to very large depth. On the way down, they collect many cosmogenic ray backgrounds, but they then locally, they melt and they refreeze, and you start with a clean mineral being born at the great depth so that you are you erase the cosmogenic backgrounds you've previously accumulated. However, any mineral you will pick up will have some residual amount of radiogenic backgrounds, right? So then what we do is, to some extent, you just have to live with them, and you calculate it, you ask, how does the track spectrum you get from work? And the most dangerous thing you have to work with are, again, neutrons. And the reasons are, right, if you have sort of MeV neutrons, what they do is they elastically scatter off atomic nuclei, so they lose their energy, with large free paths on the order of centimeters, and then can cause KV nuclear recalls that look exactly like what dark matter would do. So what we do is we calculate what these backgrounds look like, including all the relevant sources of neutrons. Now there's one nice quirk that you can do in your sample. What I'm showing you here in these two plots are the nuclear recall energy spectra you get from these radiogenic neutrons in two materials, halite on the left. Halite is just ordinary rock salt, and epsomite on the right, which is relatively similar. And the big difference between halite and epsomite is that epsomite has hydrogen. And the scales on these two plots are exactly the same, but you see that at epsomite, the nuclear recall spectrum induced by these neutrons is a few orders of magnitude lower. And the reason for that is the presence of the hydrogen. And the reason hydrogen helps is exactly the same reason why we put hydrogen in nuclear reactors to moderate the neutrons in there. Hydrogen is a very efficient neutron moderator, basically because the masses of hydrogen and the neutrons, protons and neutrons, are of course roughly matched. So any interaction of a neutron with a proton in such an interaction, the neutron will lose a order one fraction of its kinetic energy. Whereas if the neutron scatters off an ordinary atomic nucleus that is, you know, an order of magnitude or so heavier, it only loses a tiny fraction. So if you have some hydrogen, you moderate the neutrons very quickly to suppress them below energies where they can induce these nuclear recalls on similar scales as to what dark matter would do. But Daniel, to answer your question, so in the end, you know, there will be nuclear recalls and backgrounds from radiogenics. And we just go and we calculate them and include them in our background modeling.
Can you validate that? So is there a piece of rock that you can take from, like, I mean, probably there's no piece of rock with the requirements that you need that it's available for you to go and look at it and validate your model. But is there something close to that that you can do?
Oh, absolutely. You can do this in the lab, right? So you can shoot neutrons at your sample to create a lot of damage tracks to understand that your neutron modeling is correct. But then what you can do is, so in order for us to be in business, we need very low uranium concentrations. Otherwise, radiogenic backgrounds are too large. But now, right, what you can do is you can pick up a sample that has a much higher uranium concentration, or lift close to a material that has a higher uranium concentration, and count the tracks in that, and to see, right, you know, does this background have the appropriate behavior? So it's certainly something that needs to be done in an experiment.
Yeah, what I mean is that the rock that you need for your purposes, it's a rock that has low exposure, et cetera, et cetera. So does that actual piece of rock exist already in the possession of somebody that you can go and just look at it, or?
I'm sure, well, in principle, yes.
Okay.
In practice, there is an issue with cosmic ray backgrounds, right? So you cannot use a sample that has lived at the surface for too long.
Okay.
Because at some point, if you store them for a decade at the surface, they could do that swamp with cosmogenics.
In fractures, you are taking into account in what you call natural defects. So as you put pressure on them.
Sorry, I don't know if it's my connection or your connection, but I can't hear you right now.
Oh yeah, I think we all lost them. Maybe he'll come back.
Okay. Let's see if he comes back, and then I'll try to answer whatever
So in the meantime, I didn't understand your point about hydrogen. Is it just that you're capturing the neutrons? What's the point?
No. So the neutrons elastically scatter off hydrogen. But they lose a large amount of the kinetic energy in an elastic scatter of hydrogen. Whereas if the neutron, say, scatters
off,
10-20 GeV nucleus, it loses only a few percent of its kinetic energy on average.
Sure. But the capture doesn't help you. You're getting rid of the neutrons, right?
So. Very good. So in our modeling, we only include elastic interactions. So it's conservative in that sense that in principle, yes, there are inelastic interactions like neutron capture, and they only further reduce the neutron flux.
I see. Yeah.
But yes, you're absolutely right that you can wonder if you would have a material, something in your sample with a relatively high capture cross-section, right? Would that help you?
Mm-hmm.
All right, until Daniel comes back, last background source that I just want to mention are neutrinos. They, of course, coherently scatter off atomic nuclei. They make nuclear recalls, they make backgrounds. There's nothing you can do against it, right? You cannot screen against neutrinos, so you just have to live with them. You calculate the background contribution, or of course, you can turn it around and try to precisely look for the neutrino-induced tracks, nuclear recall tracks as your signal. Okay, so I'm badly running into my time limit, so I don't know how far I'm going to get. So Matthias, you need to stop me at some point if you want me to stop. Daniel, you're back, I think.
Yeah, sorry. So I just wanted to ask about fractures. So do you take that into account? That's not yet in your natural defects category. If you look at a wall, you see fractures, and they can look like cracks, and they can be small.
They can be small, but they're typically, they go across the monocrystalline domain.
Not always. It's just a matter of looking at a wall. Sometimes they have tracks that are smaller than the wall size.
You mean like the wall of a building?
Yes, yes.
Oh, but that's not a crystal, right?
It's not a crystal, it's true. But I mean, how well understood is that?
So again, I'm not an expert on these minerals, right? But when we asked the mineralogists to notice, they said, no, this is not how how natural defects look. They're either longer or shorter. And the answer wasn't, it's very unlikely that you get something that looks like your damaged track. The answer was, this just doesn't happen. This never happens. This is not how a crystal works. So again, this is something that obviously has to be checked experimentally. More than people telling us that it has already been checked. But as far as I understand, natural defects do not give you something that looks like a 10 nanometer long track. But I absolutely agree. I mean, this is something that we have to be very worried about. And that's one of the first things that has to be done in the laboratory, right? Look, how do the natural defects look? Do we really not get anything that with a given readout method in a given material, do we not get anything that looks like a damage track, but comes from natural defects in yourself. Okay. So let me briefly talk about this slide because it also makes an important point about how such an analysis would work. So what I'm showing you here is now the recall track length distribution you would get from these different sources. So this dashed line are neutrinos, astrophysical neutrinos, solar neutrinos down here. And this dash dotted line are the neutron-induced backgrounds. And then here you see a few examples of what dark matter would look like, the spectra that magnetic interactions would introduce. One important point I want you to take away here are the actual numbers, how many tracks you would get. So this is per kilogram mega year, right? So in an exposure that a kilogram mega year is the same as a gram giga year, right? Something that you could expect to actually achieve as I will show you in a paleotech-type experiment, we're not talking, as people do in an ordinary detection experiment, about trying to operate a essentially background-free experiment. But there's going to be many tracks in there. There's going to be, depending on the background source, thousands, tens of thousands, or maybe millions of tracks in a given sample of, say, a gram-sized sample that is a giga-year old. So what you're trying is not like in a direct detection experiment, running a background-free experiment and looking for two tracks in there or something, right? Sorry, two recalls in there. But what you're doing is you're measuring a bunch of tracks and you're asking, what are these distributions? What do they look like? You would run an analysis that is much more similar to something you do at a collider, for example, right? Where you have a modeling of your backgrounds and you know the shape of your backgrounds. And then you ask, does the signal I measure, right, the total differential distribution in whatever quantity you're measuring in, does that look like my background only distribution? Or does it have some deviations in the shape that comes from dark matter? That looks like it could come from dark matter. Okay, so let me say a few words about how one can do a readout of such a sample. One idea that we're quite excited about is to use a modern version of X-ray microscopy. You would have to go to a synchrotron because you need hard X-rays to get the required resolutions. And the idea is to use a focused hard X-ray beam. You shoot it at your sample, at a small part of your sample. You get a diffraction image. You scan it over your sample. That way you can build up a diffraction image of the whole plane. And then you rotate your sample just like you do if you get a CT done in a hospital. And that way you can build up a 3D image of how your sample looks. And what people have done with this is just sort of a demonstration image. They've taken a picture of a glass colloid here that I've just engineered to demonstrate what this technology can do. So here you see a zoom in, and this bar is 160 nanometers. So what they've done is they read out this bulk sample with this resolution of something like 15 nanometers in 3D. So this technology potentially allows you to read out bulk samples with 3D resolution on the order of something like, 15 nanometers or so, which was my benchmark that I previously showed you that corresponds to a nuclear regular energy threshold comparable to what you can do in a liquid xenon type experiment. And we believe you could realistically, this will take resources and time, but you could read out samples on the order of something like 100 grams within a reasonable time frame with such a material technique. Another idea how you could read out these damage tracks, if you want to look for much smaller damages, is to use helium ion beam microscopy. So this is similar to any other charged particle microscopy. What you do is you shoot helium ions at your sample.
Hi, Sebastian, I ask you, so how big are yours? Do you need to break the sample apart to do this?
Yes. You cannot stick 100 grams at once into your synchrotron, but you can do relatively
Would that introduce problems? Would that introduce the fact how you cut it introduce
yes.
problems?
Yes, you have to be very careful with how you do sample preparation for any readout method to not introduce damage, features at the surface.
Yeah. How big are the samples? Meaning how, like a 100 gram thing, how much do you have to grind it down?
So for this small angle X-ray scattering, I believe the samples, what you put in is something like a tower, sort of, is how the geometry looks like a cylinder. And I think, if I remember correctly, they can be like 100 microns in diameter, but then they can be quite big. They can be like centimeters high. So, it is a macroscopic sample that people can look at with this.
Yeah, but you need to cut it down in slabs, basically, kind of. Like, one dimension needs to be short.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And that dimension can still be, 100 microns.
Okay, so it can be larger than the size of the tracks you're looking for.
Orders of magnitude larger. Yes. Yes, you do have to worry. You do have to worry about sort of effectively losing some exposure as you go to the surface. But samples are large compared to the tracks. So you don't have to worry that, you don't have anything that is fully contained. You do have
do you introduce backgrounds? Do you introduce backgrounds when you take it out to the surface?
Yes, cosmogenics. But
So
here in the bottom I showed you what is the neutron flux that you get if you put it in a shallow, underground surface storage, 100 meters for a year, you introduce 30 neutrons, which is the same as you get in a giga year at 5 or 6 kilometers of depth. So the samples are small. We're not talking about ton scale samples. We're talking about small samples. And the giga year helps you. So yes, you have to be worried. You cannot take a sample that has been sitting at the surface for decades, but you can take the samples and store them for, order years in a shallow under storage and then bring them to the surface to do the actual readout. And what helps you is that the samples are physically small, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that they've been recording whatever you're actually looking for hundreds of millions of years or billion years.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. So let me go.
So given our time, I'm not sure how much material we still have to go through, but one suggestion would be to go through results and then
I'll wrap up
for questions.
Absolutely. After. Yeah, yeah. I'm not going to go through the rest of my slides. Okay, let me just finish with CDMI and beam readout. The nice feature of that is that you can get sort of nanometer resolution. So here, this is a demonstration picture of people showed a graphite flake just to show the resolution. They've demonstrated sub-nanometer resolution with this. You can read out much smaller samples. So here we believe you can do something like 10 milligrams maybe of material, not like 100 grams, which you can do with this small angle X-ray scattering. Okay, so let me show you the dark matter projections of what you can do, what we believe you can do with this. So this is the same plane as before. Dark matter mass with this interaction cross-section, this gray region are existing limits as of now. And this blue region down here, just to guide the eye, is the neutrino flow in a xenon type direct detection experiment. And these different colored lines is what you can achieve with a paleodetect type experiment. Here, the benchmark is the CDM ion beam readout, where we believe you can do something like 10 milligrams maybe of sample material that has been recording stuff for a giga year. And you can reach resolutions on the order of 1 nanometers, right? Which are basically the shortest tracks that you could even call the track. So here you see that the sensitivity promises to get you many, many, many orders of magnitude below current limits for relatively light wimp masses, right? So this type of readout is geared at getting the lowest possible nuclear recoil threshold while sacrificing some exposure. Instead, you can run a different type of experiment. If you do the small angle X-ray scattering, this synchrotron based readout that I've told you, where you give up some spatial resolution to gain exposure. So we assumed you can read out something like 100 grams of material. You lose sensitivity to the very light WIMPs because they don't make sufficiently hard recoils anymore. But you do gain a lot in the sensitivity to heavier WIMPs. And this is similar to a normal direct detection experiment, right? If you want to low mass WIMPs, you run the important thing is to optimize to bring down your recoil energy threshold. If you look for heavier WIMPs, the important thing is to maximize your exposure. So with this benchmark, you see you could probe WIMPs that are cross sections that are an order or two below current limits. So let me skip the neutrino part. There's one more point that I want to make because it's something that is very unique to paleodetectors. So what I've told you so far is just to look for how many defects do you get in such a sample, right? But there's one other really cool feature you get for because these guys have been sitting and recording whatever happened for order a billion years for geological timescales. So imagine what you're doing is not just picking up one rock and asking how many tracks do I get in there? What's the distribution? Do I see something for dark matter? But imagining you have, say, 10 rocks. One of them is 100 million years old, the next 200 million years old, et cetera. And you measure the rate of whatever your signal is in each of them. Then what you can do is you can gain some information about the rate as a function of time going back over geological timescales of whatever signal you could detect. And that's something that is essentially impossible to reach with any other technology. There's very few examples of how we can measure anything that happened hundreds of millions of years ago right here, right? Of course, we can look out in the cosmos and we can measure stuff that is on our light cone, but it's very hard to measure anything that happened close to Earth hundreds of millions of years ago. So what you can do with this is you can, for example, ask, right, did Earth in the last hundreds of millions of years cross through a dark matter mini halo, right? That would have given us drastically enhanced local dark matter density. Or you could look for even crazier ideas, like for example, does dark matter form a dark disk because some component of it has dissipative interactions? And then Earth would periodically pass through this dark disk and you would get periodically a very enhanced direct detection signature. So this is some unique application. These type of things you could probe with paleodetectors, but not with any ordinary direct detection experiment. All right, so let me wrap up and just leave you up here with my conclusions. I hope I convinced you that paleodetectors have a bunch of applications and are not totally crazy to try. and to do feasibility studies of how well this could actually work, apart from the dreams of what the theorists like me have. We've looked at a bunch of applications. I didn't get to talk about neutrinos, but I'm happy to talk about it if you have any questions about it. You could look for dark matter. You could look for even funnier things like time-dependent signatures, both of dark matter and of neutrinos. And I'm sure there's other things you can do is if you imagine, right, what in essence what you have is something, a detector with KV thresholds and exposures on the order of a big water Cherenkov detector, 100 kiloton times detector. All right, thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Sebastian. It's a very interesting talk. I mean, now we can open up for discussion. Anyone else?
So I guess the main thing that I guess what Daniel was asking before is, let's say you have a signal. How will you be convinced that this is dark matter and not some unaccounted for background in this setup?
Yes. So you're absolutely right that it is the naive thing, right, is to say is, you know, with such a not very well controlled experiment, the only thing you could ever do is exclusion of it, right? How can you ever convince yourself that you actually see something? But I don't think that's strictly true. So right, you can do a number of things. A, like I said, right, what we're doing is not like a normal direct detection experiment where you see two events or three events, and you don't really know much about the spectral shape or whatever of your signal. But you would see at what we call our discovery limit, right, how far we could reach, what are the lowest cross-section that we can touch. Even down here, we would still see hundreds or thousands, depending on where you are in mass. If you go down to lower masses, tens of thousands of events from...
Hello? Did we miss him?
We lost him, I think.
Yeah, he froze in a funny face. Okay. There, he's back. Sebastian is back. Okay. Hey, Sebastian. You're muted, Sebastian. You were talking and then suddenly everything went dark. We cannot hear you now.
Yeah, I think your mic, you have to adjust your mic probably again.
All right, you can hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. Sorry, where did you lose me?
We lost you at the time where you were saying, oh, this is not like a direct detection experiment.
Okay,
where...
very good.
Okay, this is around that time.
So in a normal direct detection experiment, right, you claim at the discovery limit, you would get a few events, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't allow you to characterize the signal very well. In a paleo detector at what we show as our discovery limit, right? So down here at the smallest cross section we could probe, depending on the mass of your dark matter candidate, you would still get hundreds to tens of thousands of events, signal events in your sample. So you do get information about the spectral shape of your background, right? So you can use that. You do map out, right? Does the spectral shape of my signal, does that match what I expect from dark matter? And of course, that's still not going to convince anybody. What do you then add? You go to a different sample, right? A sample of different chemical composition. You see, you check, right? Do I find the same signal? If it's a sample of different chemical composition, depending on how my dark matter is supposed to interact with ordinary matter, right? There might be some scaling with the chemical elements, etc., right? For example, the famous A square scaling for coherent spin independent scattering. Do I see that the signal behaves correctly in another sample? Then I can go and I can find a sample that is younger, right? Do I see that the signal disappears as I go to younger and younger samples, et cetera, right? So it's not easy, but I think there are ways how if you would actually see something, you could convince yourself that it's not just a background, but because you measure a large number of events, you do get information about how does your signal really look, and then you can cross check with other samples, right, where the signal should scale. Does it behave correctly? Does this really look like a dark matter signal, or is this something else?
Thank you. That was really nice.
Yeah, I had a question, but I guess you kind of already answered with this last. Like, because for an individual sample, you said you are also using the number of observed events to make sure the history of your sample is the one you guessed, right? So if you see events over the background, there could always be either dark matter or a different history. But I guess if you use 10 different samples, you...
You're right, but those are not the same events. So if I go back to how the spectrum of Lagrange, for example, you can use tracks that are quite long, longer than what we would expect from dark matter, to understand the neutron background. And then if you independently measure the uranium concentration around your sample, you know what the neutron background is supposed to be. So you can learn something about your sample, or you can use the very short tracks that are dominated by solar neutrinos to learn something about your sample, or these fission fragment tracks that I talked about in the beginning, what I've shown you the pictures of, those are at even, you know, a few orders, theirs are like at 10 microns or so, so they're not on this plot. They're even longer, right? So you use tracks to understand the history of a sample, but you use different tracks. And mm-hmm. So something we've done, for example, in this recent paper is we've used a very flexible sort of statistical framework to do this, maximum likelihood ratios, where we floated many of the background events. And what we've shown is that if you use a number of samples of different ages, even if you, for example, you don't put in any external information about what do you expect the age of your samples to be, you can then use the normalization of, for example, the neutrino events to internally self-consistently calibrate and the age of your samples. So yeah, I mean, it's sort of a very detailed thing if you want to see how it works really in the statistical framework. But we've shown that you can actually do this. I'm happy to chat about it at length if you want to know more.
Thanks. So what's the status of this practically?
Unfortunately, life is slow. Trying to actually do something in reality is slow, right? So there are some groups trying to do feasibility studies. There's a group in Germany, there's a group in the US, and there's also a group in Japan that are trying to do something. Unfortunately, COVID has slowed down experimentalists even more than us, right? As many of you know, it was very hard for experimentalists to even get access to the labs for much of the last, by now, 1.5 years. And that has slowed down things a lot, unfortunately.
Yeah. But I mean, the time scale to do this though won't be very, very long, right? In principle, all you have to do is take the sample, cut it up, and do the measurement.
Yes, but so to get to sample sizes that would actually allow you to do competitive dark matter searches,
yeah,
that is a relatively large effort. Because
I see. What is the roadblock here? What is like?
So first, you have to demonstrate that you can do this readout. That should be relatively easy to do in principle. You could do this in principle, I believe, on like year timescales, and hopefully, yeah, when people get access to the labs again now more easily, this will accelerate to some extent. But then you have to scale it up. So these sample sizes that we use in our forecast, we believe they're reasonable. There's something you can achieve with these technologies, but it does take time and effort to show that you can actually scale it up. You have to develop dedicated. So one thing is, for example, if you want to do this helium ion beam readout, you can do this at the scales, but you would need to operate, you know, 5 or 10 or something, you know, a few of these microscopes more or less continuously. You have to learn how to do that. And then you have to learn how to do the analysis, right? Like I told you, there's, you know, it's not like one or two events. There's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of tracks. So you have to find, for example, you would have to develop essentially a machine learning algorithm of how to automatically scan this data, mm-hmm, and find these tracks. Again, this is a ideal application of machine learning, right? Because what you're literally trying to do is pattern recognition in a image, right? So this, I don't think this would be hard, but so to scale it up to exposures where you could actually do physics with it is something that will take, you know, order a decade at least.